My name is Lawrence Rosenberg, and this is the Alpha Human Podcast. Our guest today is Jeff Teagues, a combat veteran who spent over 25 years as an elite U.S. Army special operator. His military career spanned roles as an Army Ranger, Green Beret, and ultimately as an assault force commander and lieutenant colonel within the storied ranks of Delta Force, also known as the Unit. Throughout his service, Jeff played a pivotal role in combat operations across Panama, Iraq, and Afghanistan. These days, Jeff is focused on combating a different type of enemy, one that plagues our society. As the founder of Skull Games, a nonprofit initiative, Jeff takes a groundbreaking approach to the pursuit of sex traffickers by mobilizing volunteers in a unified mission to safeguard the vulnerable and bring these vile predators to justice and return girls and children to long sought after freedom. Jeff is also the author of the book, Where Have All the Heroes Gone? A Pilgrimage Through the Bible, the Battlefield, and Back Home Again. Part autobiography and part deep dive into the stories of King David and our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, Jeff weaves some very weighty and intense personal experiences and military missions among the threads of these Bible stories, blending the realms of spiritual and physical warfare and inviting listeners to take their own pilgrimage. With that, Jeff, welcome to the show.
Lawrence, thanks for having me. I never get used to introductions. You know what I mean? Because when people start, I'm like, who's he talking about? Oh yeah, that's me. But it feels so weird because, you know, when you're all of these things that you describe, you're in the process of them, and they're a lot of work, you know, and I don't look at them in the rearview mirror very often. You know, it's all part of me. And I think of the journey and the difficulty and the desire to do all these things, even writing a book. I mean, it was years in the making. So it is rare, and it's usually when I'm on a podcast or speaking where someone introduces you, where I'm actually looking in the rearview mirror going, man, there's a considerable amount of road behind me, you know, and it's nice. Thank you for all that. Appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure. My pleasure. Hope I'm doing you justice. So to kick things off, let's go back to the very beginning of your journey with the U.S. Army.
Yep.
I'd love to know, especially for our audience who may not be familiar with you, although I'm sure a lot of them are, what motivated you to join the military? And did you do so with the dream or goal of becoming a Ranger or a Green Beret, let alone a Delta operator?
Not at all. And I wish I had a better story for you. You know, I think the way that I describe it was, when you find men and women that find themselves in special operations, they're pretty good at a lot of stuff, but they're not great at that one thing, right? Like I was good enough in school. I got decent grades. I was on the student council. I was the president of my high school. I was the captain of my cross country team and track team. And I was a varsity athlete, but I wasn't fast enough to think about running in college. You know what I mean? I wasn't smart enough to think about going on to some, you know, academic career. And as high school was closing down, I really didn't know what to do next. And I would love to meet this recruiter someday, whoever it was. I don't remember anything about him except that he introduced me into the reserve type of going in the military. And back then they had, I mean, we still have it, but it was a reserve unit out of Chicago, a Special Forces Reserve. And I knew Special Forces, right? Because those were the movies, John Wayne, Green Berets, and some of the Vietnam. And I had read books about Mac V. Sogg and some of the storied, you know, men and women that were in the OSS that became the Special Forces from, you know, and we trace our lineage all the way back to the French and Indian War through the you know. So I knew of those things, and it was interesting to me. And I just dipped my toe in it. So it was initially sold to me as, hey, you go to this basic training for a summer, you go to advanced training, you know, and then you join the reserves and kind of figure it out from there. Well, as I was going through that process is when I heard about Rangers. I never heard about Rangers before. You know, there are some old movies about them, black and white movies, Darby's Rangers and things like that. But they certainly weren't that well known in 1987 when I was first introduced to them. So that immediately piqued my interest. And then I really thought, hey, what's a 4-year commitment? You know, like I was biting this off in chunks. And quite honestly, Lawrence, my wife and I, we got married at 19.
Wow.
And it was kind of the same thing that I thought is like, yes, marriage is for life. But as a 19-year-old, I don't have to think about it that way. You know, I mean, I love this woman. I don't need to just overwhelm my teenage mind with what this means to be together forever. Let's jump in and see how it goes. You know, and I think that's how I worked. That's how I got married. You know, that's how I ended up in the military. So once I was in the Rangers, I now learned about Delta Force. I'd never heard of them before. It was spoken in very hush terms. And then that was what piqued my interest next. But I was not qualified for Delta Force. My eyes were not to a corrected level that they would accept. So as I was moving towards my first enlistment, I had extended an extra year to go to scuba school and sniper school and to try out for Delta. So I ended up doing 5 years. I was not able to apply to Delta Force, and I became that disgruntled Ranger and decided to give college a try. And then through that course of time running, lo and behold, I was good enough to run Division I cross country and track. Who'd have thunk? You know, I ran at University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and then transferred out to Montana State. And then when I was at Montana State, I felt like I had some knowledge and experience that I had honed over 5 years, the men and women that had poured into me, these NCOs and officers, Ranger, and that I could give some of that back to these young ROTC cadets that were going to ultimately be officers. And it just kind of slowly but surely pulled me back in. And then when I ultimately found out that Delta Force was taking people that had their eyes corrected, I thought, well, let me go back in and follow that path. And that sounds easy on a podcast, right? But that it's an 8-year journey before you are an officer eligible to even apply to Delta Force, because you have to have a certain level of commands, responsibilities behind your belt. So I came back in as a Ranger. I went to 2nd Battalion, where I did an NCO time as a 1st Battalion Ranger. Then I went into Special Forces, 10th Special Forces Group, and then ultimately finished up at the unit. And all of it, I really took in bite-sized chunks. So I think we go back to when you introduced me, I never thought of this as a career. You know, it really wasn't until I was a major sitting in the Naval War College where they were talking about what it means to be a professional. It finally dawned on me, oh, the choices that I have made and the commitments that I have continuing to work into the military, I'm a professional. This is my profession. This is who I am. This is what I do. And then as a few years after that, as I was moving towards retirement, it shifted from who am I as a professional to just who am I, period. And now we're coming, I'm tying this circle back together. I've always been a soldier. I just didn't know it. You know what I mean? I've got the qualities, I've got the characteristics, I've got the calling of a soldier. The Special Forces really, I mean, my blood is green, that green beret that you wear, the motto of De Oppressor Liber, to free the oppressed. Like those are things that are just running in my veins. And when I go all the way back to some of my earliest memories as a young kid, protecting other kids that were being bullied, you know, making decisions to stick up for others, making decisions to stick up for myself and my brothers and sisters. You know, those were all things that really shaped who I was and carried me from the ages of 8, 9, 10 years old until in my mid-50s now. And here we sit.
You know, you actually just said something there, you know, and coming back to that full circle that I wanted to ask you. And so I'm just going to dig a little deeper. And I'm going to quote you from your book, Where Have All the Heroes Gone? You say, I'm a professional soldier, cold and calculated in my approach to combat. Our enemies are not innocent until proven guilty. It's quite the opposite. I'm not a cop. We collect the evidence of their guilt and assume their guilt as we develop a plan to capture them or kill them. We absolutely are the judge and jury deciding life and death for our enemies. This is not a light responsibility and one that I have always carried with incredible respect and honor. The battlefield is not the place to be merciful and gracious towards our enemies. We protect innocent men, women, and children. The non-combatants are safeguarded. We will lay our lives down for them. We get between them and our enemies. Our job is to die before they do. But when an enemy shows his colors and votes, he pays. He fights. He dies. So my question is, you may have answered it, but where does that sense of who and what you are as a professional battlefield-centric soldier come from? The gravity of it. So did you, because I understand, you know, you've realized that you've always been a soldier. I think there's a difference between a battlefield-centric soldier and a soldier. And maybe I'm wrong, but did you have the essence of what comes with that before you joined the military? Was it instilled in you, or is it truly part of your DNA?
Yeah. First of all, great question. Second of all, I really enjoy it when people quote my book because I forget writing some things, you know, and most of the time when people pull out a quote, I go, that's pretty interesting. That's some good writing, you know, and then I remember like toiling with it, like even the way all of those words came together. I mean, those are heavy things to put down on paper. And I probably wrote that 10, 15 times in 10, 15 different ways, you know, really trying to encapsulate all this. But it's still that mystery, you know, what the nature or nurture. Those are the things that I don't know. And you know, the next part of my life, I hope to maybe explore some of these things. Leadership and followership, I think, are fascinating bedfellows, right? You hear a lot of writing and talk about leaders, but you don't hear a lot of talk about followers, you know, and what people wouldn't recognize and think of is a special operations forces soldier is a terrific follower. You know, you learn to become a follower first, and we surround ourselves with men and women that were willing to follow. You know what I mean? So you go back and forth to being the leader out front to that follower. The other thing is that nature and nurture. You know, I don't know. And part of it was I was so young. I was 17 when I joined, you know, and when writing the book and looking back at these things, I learned a lot about myself. In those young years as a Ranger, those were hard years. Those were violent, difficult, and straight up abusive years. You are abused. A Ranger private is physically, emotionally, and psychologically abused. And I think some of that is very much done purposefully, right? Like you're taking what is nature and you're nurturing this into a U.S. Army Ranger that can go and fight and win and be cold and calculated. You know, that gets mixed up with just kind of guys being bullies and rank and all of that. It's a really, really difficult one to unravel. I think one of the places that I've arrived at is duty. I've really been big on duty. And duty is different hats, right? Mm-hmm. My duty as a husband. What is that? What is my duty as a husband? You know, what is my duty as an NCO, as an officer, as a Ranger, as special forces, all these, what is that duty? I just recently was awarded my black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, is another one of those things where you look back and that's a 10-year journey, right? Like you put that thing on and you realize the amount of work that came into it. So what, you know, as I knew that time was approaching, I began to look back at myself and say, what is my duty as a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt? I'm 55 years old. I have limited physical abilities. I have a very limited game. I have a black belt game, but it isn't sophisticated. You know, it's not modern jiu-jitsu. You know, what is it that I bring to this sport? And I think that those were things early on that I was making those decisions as a teenager. And then I began to consciously really, really make those decisions. Going back to your quote, again, this is that nature versus nurture idea. Somehow, some way, I'm durable. You know, I'm physically durable. I was never a very fast runner. I was never a strong person, but I just didn't break. I could bend. You know, I became an ultra marathon runner. I became, you know, these things that we did that we did in the military. I just don't break. And that's a physical quality. My bones are strong. Believe me, I have plenty of broken bones and artificial hardware in my body. But you know what I mean? There's a durability there and a resilience physically. I think that part of that has been developed as well emotionally. I think my faith walk is a huge part of it, recognizing that this isn't the end of it. Recognizing that the mistakes that we make when we are contrite, they are forgiven. And all these things are easy for me to talk to you about, Lawrence, sitting here in my house, you know, and I have to acknowledge that those things were happening subconsciously, even on the battlefield. I never like troubled myself with the decision to take a life or not to take a life. You know, I never wrung my hands over it. I never really thought about it afterwards. I made the decision with the information that I had, and I did it with integrity and moved on. And I think some of the mates that I've worked with that are still struggling with all of that, I don't know what all those ingredients are, but I think one of the big ones for me is, yeah, I made mistakes. And there are probably people off this earth that didn't necessarily deserve it. But in the context of war and what we were talking about, and the fact that there is collateral damage and war is war, and any of those mistakes that I may have done were done with integrity and honor and purity, not pride and ego and ambition and anger or hatred. I will answer for those, but I will be forgiven for those. And, you know, and I already am. So I don't know. That was a weird answer. I wasn't expecting where we were going to go with that one. But I think I think it's all intertwined. My faith life, my physical life, my upbringing, the people that have spoken into my life, and just the experiences. Oh, I'm not hearing you right now, Lawrence.
Sorry, I had myself on mute. Yeah. Do you think that some of it is that it's a young man's game, and when you get in that young, I mean, what do you really know about life? You know, you can be molded and shaped into many things, and you know, testosterone levels are through the roof, and you know, you get knocked around and beat up and forged into this, you know, into this machine. Do you think if a man such as yourself went in at a much later age, and I don't even know if that's possible, but you know, if you go in and you're 30, is that still the case? Are you still, you know, are you second guessing what you're doing? And when it comes to taking a life, I'm just curious.
Well, I think you're on to something in the respect that as you advance in these jobs, there you are expected to have time behind you. You can come in as a young ranger. You can enlist right into being a ranger. Mm-hmm. You can do that right now in special forces as well. It's called the 18 X-ray program. But most of the time, those people that are coming in off the street, they have life behind them. I think the average age of that person is like 25-ish or so. Those are folks, you know, 23 to 33. Mm-hmm. So they already have some of that lived experience. When you go to Delta Force, you have to have at least 4 years enlisted before you can even apply. And oftentimes, if you don't have the background and kind of wisdom, that whole seasoning of character, mm-hmm. we will say, hey, go back and take this job for a year or two and then come back and see us. You've got the qualities we're looking for. You're just too young. Mm-hmm. You know, as an officer, you're, you're at best an old captain. You know, you're a young major, an old captain. So you've got 8 to 10 years of time as an officer in there. So we've definitely recognized that the highest level of our professional ranks have to be men and women in their mid to late 30s, you know what I mean, and higher. I think that might surprise folks. I don't know the exact number, but the average age of men and women in the unit is around 32, 33, 34 years old. There are plenty of guys in their 40s that are still out there with us.
And I can imagine that. And it's only by the time you get there, because it's a much more sophisticated, some of the stuff that you're doing as a Green Beret or Delta, there's a lot of sophistication behind it, a lot of nuance. Army Ranger, it's a violent job. I guess I'm wondering, does age not only give you that wit? Because we're not talking about going into the Rangers at that age, right? We're talking about getting into Delta, and some of the life experience you kind of need behind you. But yeah, I think coming in very young and idealistic helps. And I'm just looking at it from my own perspective and speaking with you, wondering, you know, do all the things that you have to, all the things that you have to do, ultimately you'll be forgiven, having realized, you know, maybe, you know, this is something that was done and there was a cause behind it, and you did what was right, hopefully, right? But you really don't think about those things when you're 20. You just don't. I think about them now.
Yeah.
I didn't even think about that when I was in my 30s. And I've never had the privilege or the honor to serve. So I can only speculate from the books I've read and the operators that I've spoken to. But it's just an interesting thing.
And that's, I did have that process of learning going through that book, you know, and writing the book. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that would stand true for all ages, mm-hmm. is you can't let pride, ego, and identity get rolled into that, you know? So as a young Ranger, they break you down and then they build you back up. And part of your defense is this idea that I'm bulletproof. I'm a young Ranger and I'm faster than a speeding bullet and I can leap a tall right. building. And that idea. But you have to, you can't let that become a reality. That has to be a piece of armor you put on, you know? Mm-hmm. And I also think in the military, you are very rapidly moving from that private who's only responsible for himself to becoming a team leader, you know, or even a buddy team, you know, where you're learning that very early, where it's, hey, it's you and me, Lawrence. We move together everywhere. We do everything together. We're graded and rated on what we're able to do together. So this individuality goes away very, very rapidly, which should help you keep it out of pride and ego. And instead of it's a me, it becomes an us. Mm. And that has always been something that was important to me. Even writing out one of my first experience in combat in Panama. If you remember reading this part of it, I had a private, his name was Hale, and I needed him to bring machine gun fire down on this.
I'm going to ask you about that.
Okay. Hold off. So we'll come back to that one, but that was one of those events where I'm standing here in this room right over there at that desk, and I'm writing that, and I realize, oh, you son of a gun, this was only partly about Hale. This was about you letting your pride and ego get involved.
You know what? So now you bring that up.
Okay. There. Yeah.
But a lot of this book is very powerful. So let's dive into the book, because okay. I got to tell you, in reading your book, Where Have All the Heroes Gone? I found myself pulled into the stories and the vignettes you shared, as well as the overall narrative, the thread that runs throughout the book. It was powerful, man, on many levels. I mean, there were moments where I almost came to tears. There were moments where I stopped and reflected, where I contemplated life. And there was one point in the book where I stopped reading and I got down on my knees and out prayed. So to say this book resonated with me is an understatement. It's definitely not your typical biography. And I've read a lot of biographies, as well as a lot of biographies of special operators, so that I can have these types of conversations. Your book, your biography is actually two books woven together. It's your story and relevant stories from the Bible, primarily the stories of King David and Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior. And so let's start with this. What was the origin of this book? Tell us how this book came to be.
Interestingly, Lawrence, this is just like the question, and how did you end up in Delta? You know what I mean? It's like it wasn't a plan. It was just one step at a time. My wife and I are 35 years married this year. Mm-hmm. How did you guys stay together? It was one day at a time. It was no master plan, you know. And same with the book. It started out as almost like a personal, what do you call it? Bible study. The word is escaping me. Where I was just studying what I was reading in the Bible and the stories that I knew. And I was living in Israel. Right before I retired, I spent almost 2 years in Israel working in Jerusalem, and my family came with us, and we walked this terrain, and you know, and you'd have these conflicting things. Oh, this is where Jesus was baptized. No, this is where Jesus was baptized. This is where Jesus was crucified. No, this is where Jesus was crucified. This is where, you know, this happened. This happened. And I started to look at it from a very common sense soldier point of view. You know, like mm-hmm. what are things that are always last? You know, a well from thousands of years ago is still going to be the same well there. There are only so many water sources. You know, why would we do this? Why would we do that? So I started to look at these things. It was my own personal discovery, and God piled onto it. So, you know, just like I'm talking with the parallels of my life as a Ranger private all the way up to Lieutenant Colonel. God piled on things that kind of made it interesting for me, these seasonings, you know, and I'd be looking and I'd be studying and I try to find out what people had said before me, you know, even back in the BC era, or, you know, Herodotus, these Jewish historians, or, you know, these Catholic priests and monks and all of these different writings and all these different traditions. And then, Lawrence, every once in a while, God would show me a picture, you know, and it would be vivid. And he would basically plant in my mind, this is what happened here. This is where, this is why. And that was enough to just, I mean, that was, maybe it happened once or twice a year, but you know, if you with on your faith walk, how many times do you have that level of like intimacy with God where he shows you something, you know? And there were only one or two things in the last 5-8 years probably 8 years that God had shown me that is unique. Otherwise, if I was searching this way, I did a slight pivot, and then I realized and recognized, oh, other people have figured this out, or this has been revealed to them. Right. So it really started out as that. Hey, here are some Bible stories that we know. Here are some legends and traditions and ideas that just bring them to life and tie some things together. And then at some point, I decided to talk about how those stories, what they make me think about, and how those have impacted my decision making, or as I look back at my life, on how I see the parallels of the story that God has laid out for us. And it just took on a life of its own until I do feel like I landed on some real alchemy here, where it was this able to weave in my very personal and private and unique military stories with these biblical stories, And it landed. It was a huge experiment. And I probably worked on this book on and off for about 10 years. You know what I mean? Just writing a little bit here, writing a little bit there. And I would say it was probably about 2 years of steady work. And then that last year was really the last year of where I arrived at this formula that I thought this just might work. But again, every time I hear from folks like you, Lawrence, where it did work, because when I launched this off to the editor and said, here it is, I had no idea. I know I felt good about it. I know what I like. I know how I like to hear stories and tell stories. But I was really concerned that I would lose folks. I'd be jumping around, or I'd be inferring things that I needed to elaborate more on, or I would elaborate on things where you're like, dude, I get it. You know what I mean? You don't have to put it on the nose, you know? So I really, it was that balance that I kept looking for. Mm-hmm. And I love it when I talk to folks like you, that it was designed so every person that reads it has their own journey. I'm just sharing mine, and it should shine a light back on the path that you've walked, where you're standing, and where you think you might be going.
Yeah, I got to tell you, it definitely landed. You know, I was saying to my wife, because we're on our own journey with Christ, and you know, I was like, you've got to read this. I would never recommend that she read a book, a biography about a special operator. She's not interested. But I was like, you've got to read this book. I'm like, you have to. There are some things in here that are going to hit her hard. And yes, I was right. I learned so many things about the stories of David and Christ that I just had not considered before reading your book. You go way beyond what's presented in the Bible, and you explore like the history, the geography, the customs, the culture of the time, and you reveal these insights about the stories that many people haven't heard discussed before, such as the Jewish tradition of breaking off a piece of matzah during the Passover dinner, right? The afikomen, as it's called, and hiding it for the children to find as a game, but also as a representation of the Pesach sacrifice and the redemption of the Jewish people from slavery in Egypt, where you actually point out the etymology of this tradition, how scholars believe that during Christ's time, the afikomen represented the Messiah, who was also hidden and guessed at the Passover meal, you know, a couple thousand years ago, would celebrate when they found the afikomen, as you would if the Messiah were to come and be revealed, right?
Yeah.
Celebrate. And so you point out how when Jesus broke off a piece of matzah during that Last Supper and said that the afikomen was his body.
Yeah.
He was declaring that he was the Messiah. So that was, you know, again, that added such a rich flavor to what I was reading. And I had no idea. Or the story you tell about the angel who appeared to the shepherds announcing that the Messiah was born. You dive into who those shepherds likely were and that they were chosen by the angel for a very specific reason. And how they knew exactly what manger to go to. So I guess my question about this kind of, because you're not just relating, so the audience should know that you're not just relating stories from the Bible that are also relevant to your journey in the military and maybe beyond, but like you're going beyond the stories to look for these additional insights that we can learn from the time, the place, the history surrounding these events. And so like where did that come from? Because I want to know about that.
Yeah.
Because you could have just written a book and it would have been very interesting about, which is what you do in the book, relate a, you know, story from King David's life to something you're going through at a point in your journey in special operations. But you go another level and you go into these insights.
Yeah.
Where did that come from? What's that about?
So that is how it started. That was the, so, you know, when you remember Paul Harvey and the rest of the story?
Of course.
I mean, I used to love that, you know, and I loved it. So this was that idea again, when I'm in Israel, and I've been reading my Bible since I was a child. I mean, my parent, I was baptized when I was an infant. I was raised a Lutheran. So okay. I was baptized before I could remember it, you know, and at one point, you know, when I kind of veered from the Lutheran tradition into more of this evangelical, you know, I don't even know what I call myself anymore. I'm a follower of Yeshua, you know, but as I moved into these spaces and you'd meet these born again Christians and they'd have these events, you know, and I was a little bit jealous. I'm like, I want to be a born again Christian. You know what I mean? But then just like in everything in my professional life, in my married life, you know, where you look back and you appreciate what you have. So what God gave me in my walk is a knowing, like never a doubt that he exists. Okay. He exists and we need him. And he created us to be in a fellowship with him, in a family with him. Things didn't go right. He said, you know, that, like those were just all facts to me. So I didn't have to spend my time, you know, in the doubt room. Mm-hmm. I found myself in the boring room, right? Like, oh, this is boring. I got it. This isn't interesting, you know, and I would go back and forth, on my journey as a young man, especially in my 20s, mm-hmm. where it just didn't have that much meaning to me. And then slowly but surely, as I read, I was seeing new things popping up in the Bible. And then it really was on steroids when we were in Jerusalem, like I said, all of these different pieces. And I think one of the critical ingredients that I talk about in the introduction was I began to look for patterns, you know, so a soldier is really, really good at looking for patterns and clues because you have to predict. It's just like warfare is a game or chess, you know, like chess, mm-hmm. you sit down and you play an opponent with chess. You're looking at the patterns of his moves. And now, you know, oh, he's in this defense. He's in this offense. So, you know, in gameplay, in warfare, you're looking for patterns and you're making assessments off of sometimes micro shots, right? Like Malcolm Gladwell's blink, you know, this idea of micro slicing where I don't need to see a pattern for long. I just see it a little bit and I'm able to make a decision. Again, I'm drawing that back to about mm-hmm. jujitsu. As long as if I can touch your foot, if I can touch your shoulder and I can feel you begin to move, I know what you're doing next because I have my thousands of hours of exercising that sport. I know the pattern. I know where you're going, or at least I know your three or four choices. And at one point in Israel, I realized, oh my goodness, God has laid out patterns for us to see. There's a depth to this that we're just missing. There's a depth to this and a richness to this that other people recognize. And we're so busy. You know what I mean? We want that immediate, you know, feedback or that immediate gratification. Like if you slow down and you really look for these clues, this mystery that he has put down for us, it comes to life. And I keep thinking about your previous questions, you know, and I am so, I take so much pride and honor in being this guy on the vanguard, right? Like, you know, I am a servant to you to be able to write this book. I lived in Israel. I will go back to Israel. Like, there, you know, I was a servant to my country as a special operations soldier, you know, hanging out on helicopters and bringing the fight to our enemies. All these things, I am very, very honored to be this vehicle, to bring it to folks, you know. Let's go on the shepherd one in particular.
Okay.
So when you go to Bethlehem, there are three or four shepherds' fields, you know, and they all say this is where the shepherds were when the angel came to them. So one of them's right, the other two are wrong. Okay. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I still don't know which one of those is correct, but it started my pursuit of which one of these fields is the right one. I haven't figured it out, but then it led to why these shepherds. And I don't know. In your tradition of in your walk, has anyone ever told you why they believe those shepherds were selected to be the first to hear that Jesus? Okay. So in the Lutheran tradition, a lot of things I was told was, well, because that designates how God came for everybody. The shepherds were lowly people. They weren't, you know, they were in the lower caste. So he was demonstrating that he came for everybody. He didn't just come for the rich. It's the same thing they say about Mary. You know, it's like, okay, it briefs well, but that's just straight up lazy, Lawrence. That's just lazy. Okay. Because we used to know exactly why he came to those shepherds. And again, I'm not the first one to have written this or come up with this. These were, I call them special forces shepherds in the book. These were Levitical shepherds, specially selected and trained to look for the Passover lamb. And where the Passover lamb was going to be born was prescribed in the Old Testament, the distance from Jerusalem, the fields themselves. So when you go back into this history, David was a Levitical shepherd. So David's fields are the same ones where a bunch of other things happen as well. Ruth and Boaz, these same fields. So these are shepherds that are looking for the Passover lamb. And when Jesus is born, the Passover lamb, they're the first to be told by the angels, hey guys, what you're looking for, he's in the manger. And he's wrapped in swaddling clothes. So like I talk about in the book, and this is one of my favorite epiphany moments in this discovery, is when the shepherds would find that ewe that was giving birth to the baby, they would take it to the manger where it was warm, Magdala Dera, where it was warm and it was lit, and they would have that baby and they would inspect the baby to make sure that it didn't have any, you know, broken bones or, you know, that it was pure. And then they would wrap it in swaddling clothes and set it in the manger so it wouldn't thrash around and bruise itself. So like, once again, when you're looking through this and you hear and you see God write in the Bible that Mary wrapped Jesus in swaddling clothes and laid him in the manger, what a weird thing to say. Yeah. You know, so that's my clue as a soldier, right? Because I listen in on Al-Qaeda and I listen in on ISIS and they say something where you're like, that's weird. What do they mean by that? So, you know, this was that same idea when I read the Bible and it says he was wrapped in swaddling clothes and laid in the manger. That's weird. What? Why is that in there? Well, because God's telling us and he's telling the people of that day, for thousands of years, you've been looking for this lamb. And for thousands of years, we've had this tradition on how to identify who that lamb is and to have that fulfillment all come to life. And then again, so it didn't all come at once, right? Like, I don't remember what came first. I think it was the Levitical shepherds came first, and then it was the manger, Magdala Dera. Cause I'm going through.
Right. Cause then you go on, take us on a journey of trying to figure out which manger it was.
Right. Cause in the Bible, and again, you have all these different, you know, it's written in Hebrew and translated and all that. So, you know, I wish I spoke Hebrew and Greek. I don't, but I try to reference those as much as I can. But, you know, by and large, the angels just say the person you're looking for is lying in the manger right now. So either it's not in the Bible where they're given directions. Mm-hmm. So, now you're in the military, we make these courses of action, right? We go off of these assumptions. Okay. So assumption one is, it's just not in the Bible. It just, God didn't say that the angel said, go here, take a left at this, you know, find that, take a right, it'll be down behind that back alley. So they just didn't either include the instructions. That's one possible. Another possible is what she did say had the clues inherent in it, and we're just not sure what it is. So that now again becomes this idea of Magdala Dera. And then that sprung off into one of the other chapters of there was no room left in the inn. What? That's weird. You know what I mean? So there's just all through the Bible, all of these things that God lays out in very simple phrases most of the time. And he wants us to dig deeper. And he certainly called me to dig deeper and share it.
Yeah. So I think you, in the book, you call this the Easter egg approach.
Yes. Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Easter egg approach. But so I don't know, because you say that's the way you hunt men on the battlefield as well.
Yeah.
Using the Easter egg approach. So, you know, did you figure that out, how to do that from your experience on the battlefield, or vice versa?
Yeah, it definitely came from the battlefield. I read my Bible now because of my experience. You know, and it goes way back. Even I went to sniper school as a corporal back in 1988, probably. Mm-hmm. And that's one of those things that they teach you is you're not going to see what you're looking for. You're only going to see a little bit of it, you know, and it's just going to look out of place. There are no straight lines in nature. You know what I mean? When things are supposed to be still, they should be still. If something's moving and it's not windy, you know, so even as a sniper, you're learning what it is you're looking for, and vice versa. You're learning how to protect yourself. You're learning how to put these different pieces of camouflage. You're finding these loopholes that you're hiding behind. But if somebody lines up that loophole with you, oh, you're exposed. You know, so that was how I was trained as a soldier. And then living and walking in the lands in Israel, it just became the thing that I laid over all of it in the physical space and then on the Bible itself. Oh, you're muted again, Lawrence.
Yeah, we're close to a fire station, and they blare this this siren off every, like, I don't know, it just comes at random times. Anyway,
let's talk about that for a second, though. So that's what people are looking for, right? When you're in this faith walk, people want the siren. When God's telling you something, they want it to be preceded with a giant red light and a siren. Like he's got my attention, you know?
Right.
And there are times when that happens, but you're talking very, very few.
Mm-hmm.
But God usually speaks to us in a quiet whisper. I love that story when Elijah is being exposed to God, and this tornado comes, and all the cyclone and this earthquake, and God isn't in any of that. The big red siren at the firehouse, he's in that quiet whisper, and that's where, you know, I want to encourage people, when you're reading your Bible and you're praying and you're talking to God, and you're you know, speaking with Jesus, man, just sit and breathe and listen. It's not going to be a red siren. It's going to be a feeling. It's going to be an impulse. Mm-hmm. It's going to be an emotion. Man, let that be the communication.
Powerful. Yeah. And you know, you bring up Israel, and your time in Israel, in the book, and you implore the faithful to go to Israel while serving in, I'm going to quote you here, while serving in the military, I was fortunate enough to be assigned to Jerusalem for a few years, as you've said. There, I felt like I'd be given access to truths that had been locked away in a vault, long forgotten, seeing the actual terrain, rereading old Bible stories and praying with intention seemed to open more and more sections of the vault to me. And, you know, so I guess one of the questions I have is, in imploring the faithful to go to Israel, and in the back of your book, it's really awesome. You put a number of places that we should visit. Like, you know, it's that I'm definitely going to be using that. I've never cool. gone to Israel. My brother's been there twice. But you, so that's a really cool part of the book as well. Having that insight in there. I haven't seen it compiled anywhere like that. So that's like perfect for me and my wife. But, you know, are these, do you feel it? When you're there and you're on the, I think the Via Della Rosa, for instance, or you're overlooking what would have been, you know, Golgotha, is it, you may use the term palpable, but then again, it's a whisper. Do these things, while you were there, do these moments, these places, these instances, do they call to you?
They call to me right now, Lawrence. You know, I think, again, I don't know why, but I'm connected with it. I cannot wait to go back. And the way I described it in the book, if you remember, I call them these thin spaces. And
hold up, don't go
okay.
there.
Yeah,
it's but another.
Yeah, and it is amazing. And but once again, you have to get outside of yourself. You know, and when the first time I went to Israel was in 2009, and I was working out of Tel Aviv. I think I was there for about 6 months in Tel Aviv.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go visit Jerusalem, and I didn't like it. It was busy. It was confusing. It was one of those cities where, like, north is that way, but it feels like it should be. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, right. Just one of these cities, and you don't have a lot of reference because there's a lot of hills. You know, like when I'm, you know, when I lived in Colorado, the mountains were to the west. That's mm-hmm. easy. You know what I mean? When you're living on the East Coast, the ocean's to the east. You know, there's certain kind of big markers where you kind of know where you are. Jerusalem is very confusing. The streets are all confusing. You get into the old city, and I just couldn't get outside of the cacophony of it all. You know what I mean? I couldn't get outside of the humanity. Like when you go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, it's busy and people are shoving and people are yelling, and it's not cool. But then when you go there at 4 a.m, when it is first opened up, bro, I get tears and tingly just thinking about it. Like, God is there, you know, and Israel is the promised land. Somehow, some way, God chose this plot of land. And in book two, I'll give you a little preview.
Okay.
I'm working on book two.
Awesome.
And one of the things, because we, again, as believers, we know that Israel's the promised land. Well, why is it the promised land? Oh, I don't know. Cause God said it was, but why? Why is it the promised land? And I believe, and other people have believed before me, well, the Garden of Eden, it's where it all started. The Garden of Eden is in Israel. We misconstrue when you ask people who have studied a little bit, where is the Garden of Eden? And they'll say in Iraq at the confluence of the Tigris and the Euphrates. Well, the Bible doesn't say that. It says it's at the headwaters of the Tigris, the Euphrates, the Pishon, and the Gishon. So one place it's impossible to be is at the confluence of the Tigris and the Euphrates, because it's very, very clear. It's at the headwaters of these four rivers and springs. Mm-hmm. So now you're looking for those headwaters. So I'm going to put that aside on the geographical side of it. But the other part that this is the chapter I'm working on right now, is God created Adam, and then he placed him in the garden. God did not create Adam in the garden. He created Adam somewhere else. And I'm going to leave that as a cliffhanger, because I think there are clues where God created Adam.
Wow.
But then he places it in the garden. And I believe the garden is Jerusalem. I believe the garden is where the Temple Mount is. I believe the garden is where the Holy of Holies was in the temple. And when you look at the decorations that God is very descriptive about on how he wants the temple to look,
mm-hmm.
it looks like a garden. It's trees and plants and fruit and animals. So I believe, without a shadow of a doubt, the Garden of Eden is there on the Temple Mount. That's why he had his temple built there. That's where he has continued to commune with his people. That's why that place will always be special. And when the world ends and we're in that final conflict,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be right there. It's going to be fought over that tiny, tiny piece of land where God first touched down and communed with humans.
Well, I can't wait to.
Yeah.
That's a great cliffhanger, by the way.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We're going to come back to the concept of thin spaces and
yes.
the Holy Sepulchre soon. But I want to, so in a different part of the book, I want to quote you. I want to combine two quotes
okay.
from different chapters, but they're both related. So they work together. And just for context, one of the quotes is about a story you tell from the U.S. invasion of Panama back in 1989. And this is about Hale, right? It's about your approach to Hale after he had failed several times to neutralize a target that was firing on your team, which you were going to talk about earlier. Ultimately, we come to realize his failure was intentional because he ends up telling you he didn't think he could kill anymore. And so you had him removed from the team after coming down on him like a ton of bricks. And in the book, here's what you say. You say, I wanted to be a monster hunter, and I was ready to crush anyone who wasn't with me 100%. That's the danger of becoming a monster hunter. You have to learn how to turn it on and off. Sometimes it takes a monster to defeat another monster, but I had not yet learned how to switch back and forth. And here's the other quote. When I am no longer expected to hunt monsters, I pray that God will continue to help me tame the monsters that still wander around inside me. So, what monsters roam within you? Can you talk about that?
So maybe someday I'll have more understanding of what those monsters are. Mm-hmm. They're there, Lawrence, and I can feel their presence. I don't know what they are. I don't know who they are. I don't know why they got there or how long they're going to stay. And I'm okay with that right now. So I think one of these themes that we're on with this podcast is I try not to even though we're getting into all these details, I'm trying not to overthink some things. Like, I accept the things that I understand, you know what I mean? And the mysteries that exist within me. Mm-hmm. I know what I've seen. I know what I've done. I know what I've been exposed to. I know what I'm doing now. You don't escape that without cuts and bruises and scrapes and scabs and scars, but they're just distant enough for me right now. That they're the shadows, and I can write about them. And as I write, I think I begin to understand them a little bit more. Yeah. So honestly, I don't even know. I am not ready. I don't know if I will ever go to a psychotherapist or a hypnotist or ever even really talk about these things. Mm-hmm. Other people will. Other people do. You know, mm-hmm. I've got one of these things that's happened in the soft community are people are taking psychedelics to see and feel and heal. You know, that's something that I would consider, but I would be very much more specific. You know, if I ever went somewhere and did a psychedelic therapy, I would be very, very intentional about wanting to talk to God and experience God. I don't want to be intentional about staring my monsters in the face. They're controlled right now, and that's okay. And I'm waiting, and I'm ready, and I can feel them bubble up every once in a while. You know, even you asking me the question, I could feel them in there. You know, I can feel them jockeying, and then they're quiet. And at once again, you know, dude, if you believe God is in control, if you trust God, then why do we have to second guess everything all the time? I don't understand what's happening even inside me sometimes, but I look at the outward fruits, you know, the things that I'm able to do, the things that God is allowing me to do, the things that I feel God is calling me to do, mm-hmm. with or without the baggage that's still in my rucksack, and I'll unpack it over time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I you know, yes, it does. It makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I like that your answers are thoughtful. They're not black and white. Life is, you know, living in between those shades of gray a lot of the time. I think that, you know, when it does come to, I think you also mentioned something about a lot of people in the soft community are doing psychedelic therapy, which is, I think, can be a very good thing. And it, you know, kind of depends, I guess, what you're doing. Certainly if you're going to do ayahuasca, which I have not done, to you will connect with an entity. No one knows what that entity is, and it might not be the entity we're looking for.
Yeah.
So it's a dangerous thing to play with, because you think that you're talking to something that's helping you.
Yeah.
And a lot of people resolve a lot of issues. So maybe it is. I just don't know. But it's certainly something to be very care. I think to be very,
yeah,
very careful with.
You know, and I would add, again, I go back to this understanding who I am. I can carry heavy shit. You know what I mean? I'm not saying it might feel a little bit better to have a lighter rucksack, but I can carry it, and I can carry it fast enough. And that's okay for now. If and when it becomes too heavy. And I think part of writing the book was some of that load was coming off. You know what I mean? Like that, some of that was me taking a stone out and
right.
laying it in that book, or laying it before the Lord, that type of thing. And everyone has different ways that they kind of cope with this thing, you know? And I felt very compelled to write that book. I feel compelled to continue to write, and it comes at a cost, right? Dude, I violated the first rule of Fight Club. Don't talk about Fight Club. You know, like our ethos at Delta is you don't write books. You don't write books. You don't talk about it. You know, and I've tried to do it with an integrity, and I've continued to have men around me when I do podcasts, and I start to go a little bit out of bounds, and they call me and be like, dude, you're violating, you know, principle number one. All right, I'll tighten it back up. You know, because I'm so compelled, because I don't understand, but I know my own demons, and I see men and women around me killing themselves and medicating themselves with drugs and alcohol, and I know they have those demons, and I feel like parts of my book can help them heal, and I will take the dings at violating the first rule of Fight Club. Because I think the greater rule is looking out for your brother. You know, am I my brother's keeper? Damn right I am. And I may not wear the uniform anymore, but I feel just as responsible for those men and women that I took into combat and took them out of combat as I did right now, as I did back then. So I think that's all part of it.
Yeah. Speaking of your, you know, your brother's keeper, and also wanting to get back to the concept of thin spaces, I'm gonna talk about a particularly tragic but powerful moment in the book. It's an experience you had in Samarra in Iraq, where you talk about what happened to Army Master Sergeant Richard Ferguson, Ferg as you call him. I guess is that was his nickname, Ferg. But I'm gonna quote you here. You said he did not have a chest left. Every bone appeared to be broken. Even my slightest touch produced a weird crackling sound, like I was crushing a bag of thin potato chips. I didn't know what to do, so I just kept trying to breathe for him. His chest would slightly rise with each of my breaths, but little else was happening. I also prayed that God would save him. I prayed that he would not die, not here, not like this. Then a strange thing happened. This place on the side of the road just outside Samarra in Iraq became a thin place. So, can you describe for our audience, Jeff, what happened next? Because this is a powerful story, and it needs to be told to be appreciated, especially when what happens next, when the story of what happens, when it's coming from someone of your substance, right? Having done what you've done, someone of your credibility, integrity, and experience. It resonates differently than someone telling us a similar story. So please describe what happens next while you're trying to save one of your men by the name of Ferg.
Yeah, and even before that, you know, the experience of trying to give him CPR and medical treatment, so much of my experience in combat was just like training. You know, like you know you're training right when it feels like training. You know, the very first time I shot another man, it felt like I was on the range. You know what I mean? I was going through the fundamentals of marksmanship, and I was putting my, you know, all the trigger squeeze, the breathing, the sight picture, the recoil management, and it almost felt like he was a silhouette target, like I was shooting on the range, you know. Then it gets a little bit more sophisticated. They're moving, it's dark, you know, all these types of things. But I remember through Panama, and many parts of the war, it just felt like training. And that's what was shocking to me. It was like, oh, this doesn't feel any different than what I've been training for years. In this particular case, it was different. It wasn't what I was expecting. It wasn't a CPR dummy that I was doing. You know what I mean? It wasn't a CPR mouth that I was breathing into. There was fluid, and it wasn't going as planned. And I realized, I don't know what I'm doing. I have not trained for this. I am not ready for this. And then immediately as a leader, I'm thinking, how do we replicate this, you know, back in training? How do we help our guys recognize and understand that? And then all of this kind of going together, and what I wasn't ready for was that up close and personal death as well, you know? And I think I'm coming to the realization, I don't want this to happen. I don't want this to happen. And again, God graced me with a peek into it happening. You know, I don't know who it was all for. Once again, Lawrence, I think I can look back and say, this is what I experienced. I don't know what to tell you. I know it's weird. You know, angels arrived and I saw Ferg's soul leave his body, and they stood there for a while and they comforted me, and then they left. Strange. I don't know what to tell you. You know, I'm just telling you like it is. But like you said, I'm not crazy. You know, maybe me saying something like this, other people have experienced it, or it brings a sense of comfort to these to other people. So these are all parts of this story that when we get to heaven, I'll be able to look back on, and I'll be able to talk to Ferg and ask him about his experience, and meet those two angels, and ask them about all of this, and ask God, why did it happen this way? You know, because I do trust everything is planned out. We just don't have that perspective on all of it. So even with that experience, I carried a lot of anger, about that story. I have a little less anger about it now still, because even the circumstances that led up to it were unnecessary. You know, I was asked to move in and out of a very dangerous place just so I had a boss that could chew my ass. You know, I've continued to be resentful and angry at that individual, while at the same time recognizing and appreciating he was doing his best. You know, we were all in a war that was messy and complicated, and we really all were doing our best. So that is one of those pieces of baggage that I think is offset with my anger and resentment over it all, yet with this absolute humility and appreciation that God let me peek into this other realm of existence and see what was happening there.
Yeah, you know, that's when, and I had never heard this term before, when you're administering CPR and, you know, you're not able to save him, and you see these, you said that before you saw these two angels, you said that everything got very thin.
Yeah.
Like, so can, and you also talk about, you bring it up again when you talk, as you were doing earlier in our conversation, but in the book, you talk about the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And you talk about, that's one of the thinnest, you said it's one of the thinnest places you've on earth that you've ever.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So,
yeah, I think, you know, I think when we study science, you know what I mean? We understand that things are further apart and closer together in all different levels, from a macro and a micro level. And my belief is it's similar in the spiritual realm. You know, there are these places, and it would only stand to reason, right, where things continue to happen. You know, every 100 years, every 1,000 years, something happens there. And a lot of times it's the transition from the physical life, the material, into the supernatural and the spiritual. You know, the battlefields, I feel it at battlefields, you know, I feel it at places where there was epochal shifts in history. You know what I mean? And I think it's those places where the physical life, the spiritual life, they just get closer. Almost like where you can reach out and touch it. You know, it's, you know, like when you see a sunset sometimes, or a sunrise, and it just, you feel it somehow.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like you like feel the molecules, you know, and you feel like this, like your oneness with all of it. I mean, we have those. I think holding a fresh newborn baby, you know, like we experience these things in life, and I think they're magical. And I think it's our glimpse into the way it's going to be, like the way our spiritual world and physical world was meant to be.
When you were talking about thin places, and you were talking about these events, and you said you've experienced it in places like the Alamo as well, and, you know, a few other places. And it reminded, I don't know why, but I immediately thought of the film Patton. And when George C. Scott is talking, when he's on the battlefield, there's not a battle taking place, but he's standing there and he's talking about how he says, "I've been here before," in the, you know, and he, you know, he would talk about how he would feel battles that had taken place on the, on those very same spots millennia ago. And so I don't know why, but it reminded me of that. And yeah, it's just interesting stuff. You got me looking into thin spaces.
Yeah. Well, let me take this somewhere. I don't think you were expecting. And this is one of those things I'm studying for this second book.
Okay.
Sex, the intimacy, is designed to be a thin space. It's designed to be a place where this man and woman physically share each other's bodies, but there's more to it, right? Like it breaks my heart that we pretend sex is just pieces of skin rubbing up on each other, you know, especially what I work with in sexual abuse with trafficking, women more, even more so than men, are looking for this connection. They're looking for this intimacy. There's this magical thing that happens when we bind our bodies together. That's what makes it sacred. You know, we've layered all of these other things on top of it. You know what I mean? But it's a sacred event. And you know, when like that sexual experience with your partner, that becomes that thin space where you can't even describe it. Like you're almost somewhere else. Like it's two bodies becoming one, but it's also something else. It's giving us a glimpse, and then we chase that, you know, and then people chase that. They chase that intimacy. Of course, there's the physical pleasure of sex and that kind of thing. But there's also the chasing of this intimacy, of that thin space, of that point where the physical and the spiritual come together. And I think that's what God created sex to be. You know, I find even the power of a woman, her naked body, the warmth, you know, that when when I've just been at my lowest and I'm hurting. And dude, 35 years of marriage, my wife still doesn't understand this, man. She takes those clothes off and gives me a hug. I'm healed like that. You know what I mean? So even women don't understand the gift that they've been given with their physical bodies and how that helps. It helps us heal. It helps our partners heal. It helps all of these things. So I would say, you know, as someone who's exploring these thin spaces, I very often find it in these places of warfare, and where thousands of people. I was just at Appomattox Courthouse. I had never been there before. I was there a couple of weeks ago and I felt it. It was one of those places. It's this little house in Virginia where Lee and Grant signed the treaty to end the Civil War. And you stand at this doorway of this tiny little room and you can just feel the weight of it. Two men.
Wow.
Lee, that represented the Confederacy and everything that they believed in for right or wrong. Grant, the Union. And they sat and they talked. And they talked about old times. They had known each other previously. And they began to negotiate a treaty. You know, and again, being a soldier, I was never at that level, but being at a soldier and what I try to describe in my book, I was making decisions on life and death. You know, I was making agreements. I was buying off people, the early part of Iraq. I came into Iraq with $4 million. And my job was to negotiate with Iraqi generals and colonels to have them put down their arms instead of fighting. You know, so you sit here and you just these heavy, heavy points in life. And of course, do you not think when the Civil War ended and we freed a race of people and the hundreds and thousands of lives that were in conflict for 4 years, you don't think that that's a wrinkle in time that deserves its,
yeah.
its, you know what I mean? So,
it's fascinating stuff. I mean, so, okay, quoting you again from the book. So you say, I can make mistakes. I can fail the challenges, but the password is always the same. It is simply saying, I am sorry. I need you. Please help me. I can be standing on my knees or lying down when I say it. In fact, I don't even need to say it aloud. I can whisper it or even just say it in my heart. Yahshua, I need you. And with those three words, I will live. I will be brought back from behind enemy lines. Of this, I can be sure. How did you, and again, I might be asking a question that really doesn't have a specific answer again, but how did you first receive Christ? I know you've been reading the Bible since you were a boy. So did I. When I was a young man, I went to Hebrew school to be bar mitzvahed, right? And I would have to go once or twice a week. I'm not sure I can remember whether it was once or twice now, but, and we would read the Bible. We would read the Old Testament. And, but I've only received Christ over the past a little less than 8 years now. So how did you first come to Christ? And I mean, when did you come to truly know that he lived within you to the degree that those three words, right, that you say there with those three words, to the degree that those three words mean what they mean to you, that they have that significance now?
Two different answers, I think. So the first answer, I think the best I can describe it is he's just always been there. It's like, hey, what's your first memory of your mom or your dad? You know, what's your first memory of your oldest friend? You know, probably one of my oldest friends, his name is Kelly. And Kelly and I met in probably, I don't know what it was, fifth or sixth grade. He's just always been there. You know, when did I realize that Kelly was my best friend and confidant? I don't know.
Wow.
He just always has been. You know, and that's, again, that's where I go back. I don't have that moment of this, of that I can say on this time I was born again. Jesus has just always been there. And I can think back when I was a little kid. And I'll tell you here, I'll share something. One of my sons, it's the same thing, but neither of my boys really go to church right now. You know what I mean? I'm not going to church that much. It kind of ebbs and flows, you know, when you're in the seasons of life and they're both in their mid 20s. And the book was very, very specifically written to that young man. So that was the other thing too. Has your wife read the book yet? Has she dug into it?
Oh, not yet. She's going to.
What's interesting is, you know, you read this all the time. People say, you know, when you're writing a book, you need to have an avatar. You need to have a very, very specific audience you're writing for. But then, you know, as I'm writing, I'm like, yeah, but I want women to read it. I want non-believers to read it. I want Muslims. Like, I don't want it just to be the right. Christian white male kind of a thing, you know? But as I was, again, years of going through this and having some coaches and workshops, I finally realized, A, I'm writing to myself in my mid-20s, you know, which is most memoirs. Like, I never considered this a memoir. Even when I printed it, I didn't consider it a memoir or an autobiography, because the writing workshops, those were two very different things. You're writing nonfiction or you're writing a memoir. There's two very different ways to do it. So I was like, I'm not writing a memoir. Well, in many ways, it largely has become a memoir. And they say that when you write a memoir, you're writing to yourself. Well, before I arrived at that, I realized I'm writing to my two sons. I'm writing to young men that are in their mid-20s that know Jesus and have a relationship with him, but they're just not digging it. Like, it's not exciting. Like, what we've packaged as religion, you know, Western religion, it just doesn't land for them, you know? Mm. So that's kind of how it's been with me throughout this journey. He's just always been there, you know? And part of the writing of the book almost became like this relationship, you know, even these like little contracts that I would have. I just shared this with a friend. I'm not sure if I share it in the book or not, but you know, when I realized going back and forth to war was taking its toll on my family, and of course you realize and accept that you may not come back from this, mm-hmm. you know, I made a deal with God that, hey, you can take a limb. You can take, you know, please leave me one of each at least. Like, both legs, that's a little too much. Both arms, that's a little too much. You know, leave me something, you know, but hurt me, shoot me, blow me up. I don't care, but let me come home and have a redo with my wife and kids. Not that anything was ever broke, but it was years of being gone. Yeah.
You were away and for a long time.
So I bring this up, Lawrence, because this is kind of the relationship I have with God. And I say very specifically, Yeshua, he's like my friend, you know, and we talk and he helps me. And there are those times where I have to remind myself that he's more than that, that I'm caring too much. And I have to say, will you please carry this for me? You know? And every time I do that with him, I'm able to do it more with my wife. I'm able to do it more with my kids. I'll share the story about my younger boy. And I do believe that God gives certain relationships more or less contentious with different families and things like that. Just again, just like the Jewish people. I mean, dude. Israel is his land and the Jewish people are his people. And it is a tough relationship, you know, you look at what's happening now and I don't understand all of it, but he also told us how it ends. You know what I mean? The Jews come back to him, mm-hmm. and they lead the final battle, you know? So my one time I was with my son and we were sitting on his bed and he said, you know, when you're praying and the angels come down and they sit next to you and you're talking with them. And I said, no, his name is Jonah. I said, no, Jonah, what do you mean? And he was a little kid, maybe five. He's like, what do you mean? What do you mean? I said, well, when you pray and talk to angels, do they come and sit down next to you? And he said, of course. I said, no, Jay, like, that's special. Wow. That doesn't happen to everyone. It doesn't happen to most people, you know, but that's what he knew. Now he's 23 and he's on his own walk. I don't think the angels come and sit with him when he prays right now. You know what I mean?
Yep.
But just like when we talk about the people of Israel, that relationship is there. And anytime they want it, it's there. Right. You know, and that's where I feel like I'm answering this in the form of my sons. He has given my sons their own relationship, and it's always there if they take it. And that's how I have felt. Even though I turn my back on him and maybe I wander, you know what I mean? Or I, you know, give him the Heisman stiff arm.
Right.
He's always there. And all I have to do is ask. And he never fails.
Strong. Strong. Speaking of strong, I want to talk about something you make mention of in the book a number of times. So, quote, before David killed Goliath, he had been tested with confronting a lion and bear. A giant seemed the next logical test. Right? And you say, I've met them head on with the confidence that God had prepared me sufficiently. Lion or bear, it made no difference. I killed it. But unlike David, I want to finish strong.
Mm.
Can you delve deeper into that for me? The concept of finishing strong, what that means, what it means in the context of King David, but what it means to you personally in your life.
Yeah. So I just met, I was up at Fort Lewis. It's now called JBLM, Joint Base Lewis McChord. Yep. The 3-star general officer there, his name is Xavier Brunson. Xavier and I used to work together. And 3-star general, that's pretty high up. I don't know what he's going to be next. If you haven't heard of his name, you will. Remarkable man of God. And I did an office call with him, and I brought one of my books, and I wrote in the book, finish strong, you know, I call him X. And I brought the book in, I put it down on the desk. We hugged and laughed. I hadn't seen him in years. And he said to me, he said, Jeff, God has laid something on my heart. He said, he wants me to encourage and help men to finish strong. And I just reached over and grabbed the book and opened it up. So there is a calling right now. Like a lot of us are looking to raise up young men, and that is necessary. There's no doubt about it. And I really like it. But I don't see a lot of the ministry for us to encourage each other to finish strong and for us to look each other in the eyes, Lawrence, and say, shame on you. Shame on you. Stop it. You never would have thought to cheat on your wife or cheat on your taxes or steal or do X, Y, or Z when you were a young man after God's own heart, or where you were busy with ambition. And we see this over and over in the story of the Bible. Mm-hmm. And part of it is youth. Like you're ambitious and you're trying to achieve, and you're always, you know, you're the next battle, the next war, the next $1 million, the next this, that, and the other thing. And then when you have it all, you realize it's not what you were looking for in the first place. And that little bit of that walking away that we've talked about from Jesus, as he's back there, you can't even see him anymore, or you can't even hear him calling after you.
Mm-hmm.
We now do things that we never would have done. And that, I think, is the cautionary tale of every single king. I mean, look at Saul, look at David, look at Solomon, the wisest man, arguably the richest man ever. And as he grew older, he didn't finish strong. You know, when you think of the legends of these people that we've idolized, these heroes, many of them died young.
It's a great point.
And they're caught in that snapshot of time.
Right.
You know, because so many have this propensity to do stupid shit as they get older. Right. You know what I mean? And that's what I want to encourage guys is finish strong. Like you're there. You did it. You built the Fortune 500 company. You've got a successful marriage. You've got children. You know, again, I look back at the introduction. I've done all those things. I've been to every military school I ever dreamed of going to, you know, but what's next? And now it becomes that phase of life where we are the sage. You know, we have the wisdom, and we pour it back into the next generation and keep each other tight.
Mm.
Now, it breaks my heart when you see these men and women fall after such a life of honor.
Yeah, I mean that, you really illustrate it well with the King David story. So, I implore people to read this to kind of get that context.
Hey, I had so these stories all evolve, right? Like even, I'm writing that story about David and Bathsheba and Uriah, and it was probably whatever 10th version of it where I realized right at the end that not only did David do all of these things, but he followed the Judaic law of taking his best friend's wife into his home. So on top of all of it,
Yeah.
his quadruple dick move was having people applaud David for being such a good guy.
Oh.
That didn't dawn on me until one of the final things. Well, I was in a class with a friend of mine, Anthony Randall, and he's now I'm like, oh darn it, I didn't think of that then. So what he had mentioned was when he writes the note, I think it was to Abner or Joab, whoever was the king of his army. He writes the note about what's supposed to happen to Uriah the Hittite, as they're attacking the citadel to pull back, make sure Uriah is exposed and died. Anthony pointed out he wrote that note, sealed it, gave it to Uriah to hand to Abner. So he carried his execution orders like the dutiful soldier. He didn't break the seal to read what David had written. He honored that commitment and it had his death sentence in it. So now I'm kicking myself. I'm like, darn it, that needs to be in the book. That's one more piece
It's
that, so it's
another
just
Easter egg.
another Easter egg where you're just like, oh, another dick move. He made that man carry his own execution orders. Man. So there's just always more to unpack.
It's really, really interesting stuff that just makes it so much it makes these stories so much richer and makes it more interesting. Like you said, the way it's packaged, for a lot of people just doesn't seem interesting, but the way you're packaging it makes it very compelling. So anyway, okay.
And Lawrence, I would say, I hope we don't sound, we're going to sound crazy to some people. I get that. But what one thing that I want to encourage folks is you already live this. So many people already live this, right? Like Game of Thrones took the world by storm and millions of people sat there and they were glued to their television for Game of Thrones. The Lord of the Rings Chronicles, Dune 2 is coming out, So, all of these things that are kind of sci-fi, that are kind of fantasy, you know what I mean? That don't make sense, but yet there's some sort of just true capital T truth story that you're drawn to. I'm telling you guys, that's what our story is. That's what your story is. That's what the Bible is. It is Game of Thrones, Lord of the Rings, Dune, Gladiator, Band of Brothers, Terms of Endearment. I know I'm out of movies, but I mean, it's like it's all
Yeah,
it's it it is the
it's all
most
in there.
incredible story. And then again, when you go back to your heritage, that oral heritage of the Israelites, they not only wrote this down, they told these stories. And now on one hand, of what's so amazing is how accurate it is. Like we can go back and we can see what was written down. And the precision, I mean, to every single letter. But then we also know human nature, right? And we know good storytellers. So you can also recognize and understand that even though we have the written story, Uncle Shlomo had his own version that he would tell over the fireplace, and that's the thing where you've got these capital T truths of doctrine that we can't vary from. But then we have all of these other little pieces and interpretations and legend and tradition and myth that all get wrapped in to make it a good story. And that's what I want to encourage people that are bored with faith, that are bored with Christianity. Man, shine a whole new light on it. Let yourself just see the myth and the legend and the intrigue, because it's all there.
That's strong. Yeah, I love that. I love that. Okay. So Now we're going to transition into some of the stuff you're doing now. I'll kick you off with a quote. You say that I am no longer the exactor mortis. I have a new role now, but my journey as a protector is not complete. So let's explore your journey now as someone who continues to protect the innocent. Let's discuss why you started Skull Games, what it is, why you feel that even after 25 years as an exactor mortis, which essentially means dealer of death. And for my audience, you'll have to read Jeff's book to understand the context in which Jeff references the Latin term exactor mortis, right? But with that said, Jeff, why is your job as a monster hunter not done?
Man, you ask good questions, Lawrence. And I don't know. I just don't feel like it's done. You know, when we, my wife helped out with Skull Games.
Okay.
And it was just too much for her, for all of it, you know. And I remember her, we actually got into an argument one day. And she said, why does it have to be you? You've been a soldier all your life. Like, can't someone else do it? Why does it have to be you? And I don't know. I just feel like at this point in time, it does. And I hope that there will come a point in time where God says, hey, this is your next thing. You know what I mean? This idea of thou good and faithful servant. You know, that's all I want to hear when I get to heaven. You know what I mean? All my itemized list of shortcomings. Let's just keep that over here. I just want to hear thou good and faithful servant. I asked you to do things and you did them and you heard well, and you did them to the best of your ability, you know? So I just still feel called. Now, obviously there's some practical things behind it. I know how to hunt men. I know how to build a network to defeat a network. I understand how to take information and move it into the realm of intelligence and then move it into evidence, you know, and compelling stories. So those are the two things that I think initially when I was drawn to counter sex trafficking, that I felt we had mastered, and maybe me personally with the men and women that I worked with. So as the wars went on, right, we recognized we weren't going to win Iraq or Afghanistan. Like, we just didn't have the national will. I went into both of those wars thinking we would win them, you know, and offer a whole new life for these countries. You know, it didn't take that long to recognize we just didn't have the will. You know, it isn't what we wanted to do as a nation, which is fine. I'm a soldier, you know, and bad people need to be plucked off the earth, and we need to create conditions where other things can flourish. And specifically with Afghanistan, my mission changed from winning a war or even taking bad guys off the battlefield. It became protecting the men and women, the Americans and our partners that were living in Afghanistan. You know, they were driving these roads that were dangerous. They were living in villages that were dangerous. You know, I would fly in, we would do our thing and fly out. So that became my purpose. Okay. And what that also became in Iraq, as we moved towards the end and Afghanistan, our country and the world began to turn this more from a war footing to a policing footing, where in order for us to go out and capture somebody, let alone kill them, we had to have evidence. We had to have a warrant signed by a judge. So I was now in this mindset of, okay, this isn't war. I like you, like your first quote of the book, I did have to start proving that we had a legal right. And I use this legal because this is no way to fight a war for the first place. You can't right. mix, you know, the policing and warfare in the same thing, you know? So I began to understand how to take intelligence into information, into evidence that could be compelling and sign a warrant and sign a subpoena. So that was one piece of it. That's one of the things that we do for law enforcement. We identify the indicators of sexual abuse, specifically trafficking, sex predators. We call them predators for profit and predators for pleasure. So there's different types of predators out there.
Okay.
They need evidence. In order for them to pursue the case, they need something that they can, you know, stick their claws into. So that's one side of it. The other one is what I call a compelling story. And that's what I felt a responsibility for the people on my team. So why are we risking our lives to go out after this person? Why are we moving mountains to go capture or kill this person when nobody cares? You know what I mean? Our country doesn't care. The world doesn't care. We're going to lose another guy. You know what I mean? So sometimes that compelling story was, you're doing this because this is who you are. You're an American commando, and this is what we do. We go right. And fight. You know, you're doing it because of this. You're doing it because of that. So understanding these compelling stories that people could understand and take to heart, that's another side of it. So these women and children that are being abused, most of them are forgotten. Most of them are overlooked. It's how they got there in the first place, if not being there now. So when you can put a compelling story behind a young woman, because by face value, she looks like a prostitute, right? She looks like a hooker. She looks like a whore, whatever these derogatory terms are that we're talking about this woman. Mm-hmm. That's how people see her.
Mm-hmm.
But the compelling story behind that is who she was and who she wants to be. And this snapshot that you're seeing her is a series of unfortunate events that were laid upon her by somebody else. And then interestingly, the counter to that is the pimp. When you say pimp, 90% of America has some interesting, maybe funny, positive vision in their right. mind. If right. I say whore, something pops into somebody's head. 100% negative. If I say pimp, something pops into somebody's head. So we've, and it's the brilliance of the pimps. It's the brilliance of these rapists, these exploiters. They've taken who they are and they've laid it upon the victim, you know? So we need to retell this story that these women that are finding themselves in the sex industry mm-hmm. are not there by will. They were there by force, fraud, coercion, compelled violence, manipulation. And these pimps who we oftentimes look up to like they're some sort of American entrepreneur, businessman, clever, blah, blah, blah. They're the worst, man. The debasement that they have on the humanity of women and children is unparalleled to anything I've ever seen.
So to that point, explain the name Skull Game.
So there's an old pimp, again, who many people idolize by the name of Iceberg Slim, complete piece of human trash, who used to say, pimping ain't a sex game, it's a skull game. And all the pimps know, and pimp and trafficker is synonymous. So pimp equals trafficker equals rapist. Okay. They're compelling people to be raped daily by force, just by somebody else. So they all recognize and understand, yes, it's the physical act that is being sold, but this isn't about sex. This is about controlling that victim's mind. This is about creating a sense of hopelessness, a sense of fear that controls these women. So we often depict trafficking as bondage, you know,
right.
chains, ropes, cages, that kind yeah. of thing. And while that does happen, it's very, very rare. But what that does accurately describe is the emotional, physical, spiritual, and psychological bondage that they're in. They're walking around seemingly free with the cell phone.
Right.
You know, and a lot of people think, well, they have a cell phone. They can just call somebody for help. No, that cell phone is the monitoring device. That cell phone is the thing that's constantly pinging, telling that woman that she's worthless, telling that child that he's being watched. You know, that is the chain. It's the cell phone. So we a healthy human being sees a cell phone as a piece of freedom, even a teenager, right? Like I would imagine getting your first cell phone is probably equivalent or even more of a growth step than getting your driver's license these days. So we have this idea of what that is, and it's not. It is a weapon that they use against them. So the psychological control, and as I've worked in this space, the schools that I've gone through, the survival, evasion, resistance, escape schools that I've gone to, where I learn how to resist somebody controlling my mind. I learn how to resist the torture and the physical brutality that's laid upon somebody to elicit information or to make them do something that they wouldn't otherwise want to do. All those things that I was taught, Lawrence, is what these traffickers know and do. The level of abuse and manipulation and torture, if you've ever seen it done on a movie in some torture scene from some war movie, these traffickers are doing it. And it's from the physical brutality all the way to the psychological manipulation. And most of it is in that psychological space because in many ways they have to protect that body. The body is what they're selling. So they're not going to pull out the fingernails of a young lady.
Right. It's the product.
Yeah, because that's the product that's being sold. They're not going to be hitting her in the face. If they do, there's a very intentional point behind that. You know what I mean? But it's the psychological and emotional abuse. And we also know, as we've studied this long enough, those are the lasting effects. When you talk about POWs, you know, the physical was bad at the time, but the psychological and emotional manipulation and torture that they've withstood, that's the thing that leaves just these heavy, heavy scars in their minds.
So I read an article where you were quoted as saying that there's an entire community that plots to do this, that it's generation. You said that, you know, it's a very complex, complicated way of luring and trafficking girls, pimping, I guess. You said there's an entire population that is plotting to lure your daughter into the sex trade.
Yeah.
What is that about? What does this mean? Generational and what's going on?
Yeah. So they become experts in this craft because many of them are born into it or recruited into it very young. These men and women that are working in this trafficking space. And what's interesting, Lawrence, I was just reading today, I often, when I define trafficking, it's the exchange of a sexual act for something of value that includes the level of force, fraud, and coercion. So prostitution is, you know, a sex act in exchange for something of value. And it doesn't have to be money. It can be food. It can be an iPad, whatever it is. So that's prostitution, right?
Okay.
Well, trafficking now is a level of force, fraud, and coercion. So that's the legal definition of it. If the victim is under 18, that's an automatic trafficking. But that's how I've been defining it for years. But where I'm going to start moving with it as of today, I'm actually going to go back into our stuff because the legal definition nationally, and I don't remember it exactly, but it's harboring, facilitating. There's a bunch of different words. So it's not just the sex act. So too often we're thinking about the trafficker, that man. The man, most pimps are men. There are some pimps that are women, you know, but that man. And then many, many times, most of the time, that trafficker has a 2IC, a second in command, a deputy, and she's called the bottom. And she's the one who is taking the fall for everything. All the stuff is in her name. You know, she's the outward facing. So the trafficker is behind, you know, one step removed, you know, and that deputy, that bottom is the one who people are seeing. And she's the one who ends up taking the fall.
Ghislaine Maxwell.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Ghislaine would have been a bottom. Perfect example. But then there's this other entire apparatus of people that are supporting that trafficker. And I don't, you know, I got another 10 years in this fight, I think. I don't know if we're going to get there. But that's when things are going to change. So what I mean by these communities is one of the tactics that I was not prepared for is these traffickers will purposefully have children with their victim, purposefully. They'll become the baby daddy. And because they become the baby daddy, They are now on paper and they have a legal access to the child.
Wow.
They are able to get some of the services that our government provides for that child. And then they also have that child now as a emotional, psychological bond with this girl.
Right.
And then they also use it as a piece of leverage and collateral. So once again, when you, when somebody wants to pass judgment on this victim and say, why doesn't she just leave? Why doesn't she just walk away? Why doesn't she just go to the police? Well, her four-year-old daughter is at home. And if she doesn't come home, that little girl's going to get beat. So what is that? What is that mama bear willing to withstand on a regular basis just to be able to go home to her daughter every night and tuck her in and give her a hug? You know, so that helps people understand that side of it. But here's the point that I want to get to before I retire. Who's babysitting that girl? So that four-year-old girl, you think the trafficker is sitting there playing Legos with her or teaching her how to read? No, it's that trafficker's mom or his sister or his auntie. And are we all going to pretend that that mom or sister or auntie don't know what's going on?
Right.
So at what point do we begin to hold these communities accountable, these families accountable? Because that trafficker is part of it. But this facilitation, this harboring, all of that is that next part of that apparatus. The best I've been able to do in 8 years is get an offense going at a tactical level where we are arresting traffickers. We're arresting buyers, we're arresting traffickers, we're arresting buyers that are specifically targeting, you know, 13, 14-year-old girls, that type of thing. The next phase of this is to chip away at this network. And that's where we're going to see communities completely disrupted. And I'm hoping you're going to reach that point where the risks just outweigh the rewards, you know? And right. That was, this goes back to my soldiering also. I recognized in warfare, my job was to capture or kill enough of the violence, be it Al-Qaeda, be it ISIS, be it Taliban, so that other things could flourish. You know, nobody is coming in and going to make a bakery. You know, no teachers or doctors are going to come in to a community where Al-Qaeda and ISIS are blowing everything up and terror reigns. Mm-hmm. So we have to come in to bring that baseline level of violence down just enough where other things can flourish. And that's where we failed. We did that in Iraq. We did that in Afghanistan. We brought that baseline level of violence for the rest of the world to come in and put their money where their mouth is, you know? And that's the best we're trying to do right now is get that baseline level of violence where those very violent traffickers are going away. And not for 3 years and not for 6 years, but for 20, 30, 40 years. And once we're able to get that baseline level of violence, now we can start working into some of these counter network approaches that I think will have lasting effects. But it's going to require, Lawrence, just like these wars, somebody's going to have to come in behind us mm-hmm. and rejuvenate that community. You know what I mean? When I drop a bomb on someone in Al-Qaeda's head and it knocks out the power grid, someone else has to come in and rebuild that power grid. You know what I mean? When we when we kill enough Taliban and have them scatter into Pakistan long enough for girls to be able to go to school, like when we leave, there has to be an apparatus there still. So I haven't seen it succeed, and I'm not even all that confident that it will succeed in the counter-trafficking space.
Right.
But it's worth the fight, you know? And that's where – that's the other thing that I think I've come to terms with, you know? It's the Teddy Roosevelt quote of the man in the arena. Look, I don't have to win. I just need to get in the arena and fight. And when I get knocked down, I get up and dust myself off. And the people that wear me down are the critics. It's not my opponents. I have nothing against Al-Qaeda. I have nothing against ISIS, even what's happening in Israel. I have nothing against Hamas. Bad people are going to do bad things. And good people are going to do good things. It's that middle. It's right. The critic. It's the apathetic. That's the person that wears me down. shut up or get in the fight.
Strong.
The critic, I got nothing for you.
So that's actually a good segue for this question I want to ask, this quote. I have a few more questions, and then we're going to wrap up. You've been very generous with your time. So here's a quote for you. I want to go back to the book.
I'm enjoying these quotes because when you start them, I don't remember some of them. You know what I mean? Like when you start, I'm like, oh, I don't remember writing that. Oh, I do now. Yeah.
That's cool. So here we go. At the time, David's life was desperate, difficult, and disappointing. He and his men suffered greatly, but they did it together. They suffered for each other. They were committed to each other and trusted each other without hesitation. I feel like God uses me in ways that can sometimes be miraculous, but most of the time, I only experience the mundane repetition of daily life. Then there are those times when I feel persecuted or abandoned. Regardless of how things appear on the surface, I need to continue to trust God. I may never know the full extent of the role God wants me to play in this world. There can be great highs and great lows, but most of the time, I simply exist day to day. Heroism and betrayal are interesting plot lines, but they are not the norm. So, Jeff, can you expound on this? So what have you learned having led a far more exciting life than most people? All right. How can the Bible help with the tedium and banality of day-to-day life that I feel is one of the biggest frustrations and challenges for many people?
Yeah.
Because you talk about heroism, right? You talk about counter trafficking and skull games. You talk about the decades you spent in special forces, right? Fighting bad guys, right? But the funny thing is, you even say it. For you, you simply exist also day to day, the mundane. So how? Imagine the average person that has not experienced even a fifth of what you've experienced.
Great questions. Great questions. And I think it goes back to what we've already highlighted is understanding and accepting your identity and your duty, you know? And I equate this to the Olympics, right? Every 4 years, we see these young men and women on the Olympic stage. Take the 100-meter dash, right? Mm-hmm. 9.5 seconds. They have 9 seconds of that event. And it's 4 years of work. It's 4 years of lifting weights. I was a distance runner. So similar thing, running 50-mile, 100-mile races. Even in the middle of that race, 100 miles, you are just putting one foot in front of the other. And you are living in the moment. But when I identified, I no longer identify as an ultramarathoner. When my part of my identity was an ultramarathoner, that includes what we call the trials of miles and the miles of trials. The slog, you know. Right. As a jiu-jitsu athlete, I'm a black belt now. Well, I was a white belt, then a blue belt, then a purple, you know, like that journey of getting my ass kicked every single day for 10 years. But I identified myself as a jiu-jitsu. I do jiu-jitsu. It's something very similar with a marriage. Lawrence, it was only a couple years ago where I finally came to this realization of what I owe my wife is for her loyalty. She's known me since I was 15 years old. We started dating in high school when we were 15. We were married at 19. We're both going to be 55 this year. She has been with me every step of the way. Do we have as much sex as I would want? No. Are we as intimate as we would, as I would want? No. Do we have those moments, these magical TV moments as often as we would want? No. You know what I mean? Am I a man that still appreciates the physical beauty of other women? Yes. Is there anything else I want other than my wife? No. But it wasn't always that way. And it came to this realization of, she's been loyal to me. And I made a commitment to her. And why do we always have this tendency to look over the fence, right? Oh, what does he have? Oh, what's going on over there? And we look at all these things that my wife isn't, you know? And one of these things that I found interesting, I went out with, this was years ago. Now, this was probably, I think this was 2011-ish. So what is that? That's almost, you know, it's 13, 14 years. I was out with my buddies and we made an audible, right? Oh, hey, let's go on to this. It was guys' night out, you know? And we're like, well, first of all, it started like, oh, you know, we buy like Mountain Dew. I'm not a big alcohol drinker. Like, oh, we're going to buy Mountain Dew. And they're like, man, my wife would be really mad if she saw me drinking Mountain Dew and eating Cheetos. And I just kind of let that happen. And then as it went on, like that came up all the time. And I'm thinking to myself, my wife doesn't care what the hell I drink or what I'm doing. She doesn't even know where I am. You know, then when we moved on to the next thing and they're like, oh, I better call my wife and make sure she's cool with it. And I'm not disparaging those relationships.
Right.
I'm coming to this realization of my wife isn't threatened. Like, she knows I'm committed to her. I know she's committed to me. She doesn't have to know where I am. She knows where I'm not. She knows I'm not with another woman. She knows I'm not doing X, Y, or Z. Mm-hmm. You know, so when I come home and the only thing that greets me at my door is my dog, you know what I mean? And my wife is like, sup. You know what I mean? And I want to be like, I want my wife to come give me a hug and, you know, act like I'm just saved the world, you know, but then you can't have both, right? You can't, like, that's the same woman who's worried about you and where you are and you need to call in and check in, you know? So there are things you have and there are things you don't have, you know, there are things you can't have and there are things you should have. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's all part of it, is this idea of this duty and what is my duty. And that's what I've always kind of looked back upon to get through these mundane moments, you know, and even it with the, especially in the counter trafficking space. And this is one I'm wrestling with right now, every day. I retired 8 years ago. Lawrence, God called me into this space clearly. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to do it. My wife still doesn't want me to do it. There's a lot of different things we could do. We could be very, very comfortable. We make no money. It is an uphill battle, endlessly. And I see all of these, I see many charlatans raking in the cash. All of these liars that are saying they're doing things that they're not doing. You know, I see these men in other organizations that are literally abusing the women that they're supposed to be protecting and supporting.
Wow.
And yet they're a multi-million dollar nonprofit, you know. And here we are 8 years into it, dutifully following God, my entire team, dutifully following God and doing what it is he's called us to do. And it's not easy. You know, we are, our number one shortcoming is finances.
And we're talking skull games. We're talking
skull games. Yeah. It's skull games. I haven't been taking a salary for skull games. I've been doing it for free. I can't keep doing this. I'm retired. I have a pension. So does my COO. The couple of people that don't have pension were able to pay them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm bringing this back to, but this is my duty. This is my responsibility. And I believe God has called me to do this. Why he's not helping it be easier, I don't understand that. And I struggle with that every day. But every day I take that step forward and I'm waiting for that breakthrough from him. And I don't know if it's ever going to come, you know, but once again, I find that solace, because what does God tell us? He tells us, look, I will shine the path in front of you like a candle. And I ask you to take a step, and you take that step, and then the candle moves with you. And all you're seeing is the 3 meters, you know, the COVID distance. between, you know, between you and that next step. And you just walk in duty. And again, I'm not trying to be a, be false. I struggle. I shake my fist at God some days. I my head is in my lap. It just like what is happening? But it goes back to, I feel like I have a crystal clear understanding of what my duty is right now and what my identity is right now. And I continue to try to look for those little glimmers of encouragement that God lays in our path.
Okay. So, you know, that's solid. You know, it's really solid because, you know, you talk about how you should feel, you know, after reading this book, you should feel different. And you talk, meaning your book, and you talk about how, you know, go on your own pilgrimage and explore the Bible and explore it with this newfound look for Easter eggs and you know, the exciting pilgrimage that you can make on that path of exploration. And, you know, yeah, we all live the day to day. We all live the mundane. But, you know, that path that makes it special is duty. And I think that's solid, man. I think that's really solid. I'm going to wrap it up with one last question. Because, again, you hit me with something I've never heard before. And I'm sure most of the people that I'm going to say that now we're going to listen to this have not heard this. But again, just fascinating Easter egg, if you will. So here's the quote. Well, it's not even, yeah, it's a quote. So you bring up in your book, you bring up the Tetragrammaton.
Yeah.
The Hebrew name for God in the Old Testament. YHWH. Or you said we could think transliterator is the word, or Yahweh. Yep. Yahweh. So here's the quote. There is a fascinating tradition behind this word, Yahweh. As time has gone on, YHWH, right? So the Tetragrammaton. Has been translated, transliterated, and morphed into Yahweh, Jehovah, Adonai, and other words, trying to capture the depth of those four consonants. None of these names are wrong, but none of them are right either. YHWH is simpler and yet more complicated than any single name can express. Here is why. YHWH is not a word, nor is it simply a name. I'll leave you there with that, Jeff. What is it? Tell us about this.
Yeah, the first time, and it happened in rapid succession, I heard someone speak on this, and then I read about it. And I thought, how can I have been walking with Yeshua, with Yahweh, for this long, and I've never heard this before? So it's a tradition, and I will say that this is not doctrine, but I am as sure about this as I am about anything else, because it just fits. YHWH isn't a word, it's the act of breath. It's the inhalation and the exhalation. And it is the way that the early Hebrews transliterated what God was telling them his name was. And the Hebrew tradition was the name that is unspoken, right? And right. And we say that it's a level of respect. So that's part of it. But what if part of it is just simply, it's a name that cannot be spoken, because it's not a word. It's just simply your breath. And the complexity of this, and if this is the first time that some people are hearing this, I hope you're getting goosebumps. If you're not, listen more carefully. What if the creator of this universe created everything in unison. And everything that exists breathes his name. It isn't reliant on your culture or your race or your language. It's not reliant on you being a human or an animal or a fish. Even the trees and the plants take what we exhale with the way, and they clean it and give it back to us. So doesn't it stand to reason again, Game of Thrones, Lord of Rings, that the author of this story created a universe that is 100% reliant on each other? And does it not bring you comfort to this idea that if you just sit quietly and breathe with intentionality, that the name of your creator is on your lips? And it only makes sense again, Lawrence, with these things where God tells us to always have his name on our lips. And even with the, is it the Tefillin that they call them? Where they put the scripture on the forehead and on the wrist. I can't remember what you call it.
So, yes.
But again, let it always be on your wrist. Let it be all. So, but again, the Hebrew tradition has taken that into the very physical world. But what if it's as simple as the intentionality of you looking down at your hands and just breathing? And this is tied in with what it was we were talking about, because there are those days that's the best I can do. I can just sit there and breathe, you know, and that's what I want to leave your listeners with that encouragement. What if the creator of this planet has built into your system already a level of praise? You are speaking his name every time you breathe in and out. A level of calling upon him when you need him. And we understand breath. We understand yoga. We understand breath work, the breath of life, all these types of, we understand what breathing does for us. But what if you think about this with that intentionality, and in the midst of your pain, or even in the midst of your pleasure, you just think about this mere fact that as you're existing through your day, every time you inhale, every time you exhale, you are crying out to the Lord, asking for mercy, asking for peace, asking for grace, or celebrating the fact that he has created us in a way that is beyond our comprehension.
God bless. Yeah, it's, you know, that struck me. There's a lot of stuff in this that, you know, we haven't even covered. There's so much more in your book, Where Have All the Heroes Gone? Profound moments like this, which is why I wanted to talk about this to close out. I think it's a great way to close out the conversation. But thank you for the enlightenment. Thank you for the insights that you've provided, both in your book and here today, for our audience. Jeff, where can our audience find you if they want to learn more, if they want to connect?
Yep. Wherehavealltheheroesgone.com is a website that I have. I think jeffteagues.com probably goes the same place. You can find the book at Amazon. Skullgames.io is our website. Lawrence, when we're done, I'll send you a coupon code. We have a Protect Your Family course that people are able to take that just talks about this crime. So yeah, they can find us all over the place. And I want to thank you. Yeah, dude, this week it's Friday, Shabbat Shalom. You know, it was one of those weeks where I was just stuck in the mundane, you know, and just standing at my computer and working and working and trying to tell the story and trying to connect and trying to communicate and asking God, like, man, can you not make this just a little bit easier? And you've really brightened up my week, and it helps me look back at this journey and this process, and it comes full circle again. So appreciate you, man.
Hey, man, I appreciate you. Thank you so much for being our guest today. Thank you for your service. It's a true honor. Jeff Teagues, I implore you to get the book. It will absolutely make an impact. If you're listening to this, I'm going to reread the book because it needs to be reread and reread. There's so much cool insight in there. And yeah, man, thank you very much, Jeff.
And Lawrence, the audio is me. So I got a lot of lazy buddies who don't want to read. And even the audio process was something that was really, really fascinating because I was able to say it the way I meant it, you know? So again, encourage folks to check it out that way. That was a labor of love. So thanks again for bringing it out for people to check out. Thank you, man.
Absolutely. All right. Alpha Human Podcast, we're out.